You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, The Mind of the CEO, which looks at the future of the corporation by Jeffrey E. Garton. Last show, we were looking at the chapter, Pax Americana. Half a world away, Japanese CEOs were proud of their corporate links with families and firms called kiretisu, and were interested in gaining market share and earning profits. They also touted the importance of being able to plan ahead and take advantage of what they call patient capital. Some prominent commentators asserted that the U.S. system was seriously flawed and would be outdone by others. MIT's Lester Thurow's best-selling book, Head to Head, in 1992, predicted that European-style capitalism would dominate the world. In Changing Fortunes, the book written in 1992, former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker explained why Japan was assuming global financial leadership. We all vastly underestimated several aspects of the U.S. economy and society. The incentive that competition would provide to change, the extreme flexibility of U.S. capital and labor markets to effect change, the willingness and ability to take the best from abroad, such as Japanese-style quality control or just-in-time delivery methods, and adopt it as their own, and the decentralized technological base that allowed for widespread experimentation and implementation, to name just a few of America's positive qualities. Nevertheless, it would have been difficult, even in the early 1990s, to see how completely world capitalism would converge by the end of the century. The question is, converge on what? Has there been some mixing of the three systems, or is everyone adopting the U.S. model? What I think is going on in the world is not globalization, it's Americanization, WPP's Martin Sorrell told me. And I don't mean that in a nasty French sense. America dominates everything we do, whether it be education, industry, or services. That's a fact of life. If everyone wants to build a global business, I would say it's potentially fatal not to have the strongest franchise in the United States. The importance of the American market in terms of influencing what goes on in the rest of the world is quite extraordinary. Sorrell's ideas are privately shared by other global CEOs, although sometimes with important nuances. European executives like Jorma Olilja, Jürgen Schrimp, and Richard Branson set the pendulum swinging toward America, especially when it comes to issues such as paying more attention to shareholders, disclosing more information, strengthening corporate governance, engaging in the rough and tumble world of mergers and takeovers, and even tolerating sizable layoffs of employees to reduce costs. Their thoughts have little to do with ideology, but entail instead a pragmatic recognition of what it will take to compete. The new European corporate stars are convinced that time is running out for the old order, the unholy trinity of meddling politicians, hidebound trade unions, and business dynasties for whom national interests always come first, wrote Richard Tomlinson in Fortune magazine. With a global outlook comes a healthy respect for American capitalism. Business leaders like John Brown and Jürgen Schrimpe are such masterly global operators that it is doubtful whether their corporate style is any longer distinctly European. Some European leaders also draw distinctions between their own belief about how capitalism should function and what they believe to be the U.S. model. According to Rolf Brimier of Deutsche Bank, his institution, while shareholder-oriented, accords more loyalty to customers and other relationships than do his U.S. counterparts. He sees U.S. banks as more likely to abandon a client if a better deal comes along. I think one of the many different points of emphasis we put on is trust. We don't believe in a commodity training philosophy of business, he said. We are loyal. We are not for the quick buck. We are not fly-by-night bankers. Also, we don't believe in prima donnas, the stars. What's necessary is that the team is rewarded, not just the leader or the star or the prima donna, but the entire team. In Japan, Toyota's Hiroshi Okuda is quick to acknowledge that U.S. principles in economics and business are having a strong influence, which he says is a good thing. However, he feels that at least one aspect of the U.S. system will not be accepted by his countrymen, the wide disparities of income between top management and the general workforce which characterize the American scene. Nor does he believe that the Japanese system would tolerate widespread layoffs of the kind that were common in the United States through the 1980s and 1990s. Finland's Jorma Ollila of Nokia and Japan's Yoshihiko Miyachi of Oryx no doubt represent many other foreign CEOs when they say that they would like to soften the harsher edges of U.S. capitalism. They appreciate the virtues of the American model and are proponents of most of what it represents, but they would prefer a more humanistic approach, particularly when it comes to providing more job security for workers. This entails not only a reluctance to lay off thousands of employees at a time, but also a sense that companies and the government have a responsibility to maintain an effective social safety net. To be sure, this capitalism with a human face philosophy is easier to talk about than to implement. British Prime Minister Tony Blair and several of his European counterparts have what they call a third way, something between American and old-style European capitalism. But the concept has floundered because it is so difficult to translate into practice. In the global economy, either you are competitive or you are not. What's in between? Most of the U.S. CEOs I interviewed seem subdued on the subject of the triumph of the American model. A typical response was to praise U.S. capitalism, but also to acknowledge that while it may be sweeping through the world, it was not a foregone conclusion that this would always be so, and certainly not inevitable that U.S. firms would be able to maintain their current competitive dominance. The memories of U.S. deficiencies in the 1980s are still vivid. Michael Bonsignor and Michael Armstrong, both of whom have lived in Europe and run substantial businesses there, have a healthy respect for the likelihood of growing competitive pressures from abroad. So does Rebecca Mark. There are cycles to these things, he said. It's inevitable that we'll see once again European and Japanese firms challenge us in the way we did a decade or so ago. Based on my own experience in four administrations in Washington, both Republican and Democratic, it is clear that the rhetoric of the U.S. economic agencies, the Treasury and the Trade Representative, the Commerce Department, is far more boastful about the superiority of U.S.-style capitalism than what CEOs have to say. How sustainable is the U.S. influence over the global economic and business environment. From the standpoint of those who find advantages in the continued spread of U.S.-style capitalism, presumably the most global CEOs, there are several causes for concern. One is whether the strength of the U.S. economy can continue. Looking ahead, it is certainly possible that we could see some big setbacks arising. U.S. consumers and businesses are soaking up foreign goods, services, and capital at an unprecedented rate. In 1992, the U.S. trade gap totaled over $36 billion, whereas in the first half of 2000, it was running at $30 billion per month. This was leading to current account deficits, the broadest definition of the gaps between U.S. imports and exports, of a projected $400 billion in the year 2000. Over 4% of the GDP and 24% higher than it was in 1999, which itself was a record year. If history is any guide, whether a country's trade gap widens so dramatically, foreign holders of its currency get worried and begin to sell it. Thus, the United States would be vulnerable to a weakening dollar and a reversal of the inflow of foreign capital that has helped fuel the stock market. At that point, the Federal Reserve would have to raise interest rates to prop up the greenback, but in so doing, it would choke off the business expansion taking place within the country. Another crisis could arise if politicians in Washington actually implemented a broad and deep series of tax cuts while the U.S. economy remains strong. The stimulative effect on top of economic growth, already in the 4% range, would be like pouring gasoline on a fire. As in the previous scenario, the Fed would have to tighten credit, this time to ward off inflation. As in the first case, that would spell the end of a strong economic growth spurt in the United States, at least for a while. These economic shocks would bring with them a shift psychology as the American economic machine no longer is seen as invincible. Foreign economies, which have become so dependent on selling to a booming U.S. market, would incur huge problems. Opponents of U.S. economic influence would come out of the closet, as many did in the 1980s, when big budget deficits and uncompetitive U.S. firms were a major feature of the U.S. scene. As Washington became a whipping boy for a profligacy of bad policies in capitals from London to Tokyo, perhaps none of this will occur. Still, there are other trends which could undermine the continuation of Americanization as we know it. Consider the internet. It is possible that the U.S. will not dominate the information that flows through cyberspace, known as the content. Rupert Murdoch, Michael Bloomberg, Stephen Case all emphasize the growing importance of sensitivity to local cultures. They are preoccupied with finding local programming to use in other countries, local news, local talk shows, local sitcoms, local gossip. In fact, rather than reinforcing U.S. culture, the internet may be the device to promote cultures of other nations and subnational regions. It could be the means for Spanish-speaking people or people of Chinese origin to communicate no matter where they are. It could give local cultures a way to forge relationships and alliances with the world in ways and with an intensity that has never been seen in modern times. The previous chapter explored the power of the internet, the power that it gives to NGOs opposed to globalization or its current direction. And similar patterns could emerge for any cultural or ethnic group wishing to develop tighter bonds and not the ones which probably mirror U.S. culture. A more deep-seated problem for Americanization lies in the frequent incompatibility between U.S.-style markets and the underlying U.S. culture. Ultimately, you can't have one without the other, and there lies the potential for serious tension. This distinction between markets on the one hand, politics and culture on the other, is crucial to understanding what globalization is all about, and why CEOs may ultimately encounter stronger political headwinds in their quest for an ever-open world economy than they now anticipate. Today's version of capitalism is less regulated and more ruthless than that of the 1950s and 1960s, says author, commentator Will Hutton in his book On the Edge. Its overriding objective is to serve the interests of property owners and shareholders. Its ideology is that shareholders' value must be maximized, that labor markets should be flexible, and that capital should be free to invest and disinvest in industries and countries at will. It is the capitalism of both Wall Street and financial markets and the street trading and street markets, and it's a very febrile capitalism. There are many aspects to our system that has no historical counterpart in non-Anglo-Saxon cultures. Who else tolerates such rapid turnover of products, companies, and organizational models? Who else has so lenient a bankruptcy law that allows businesses and individuals to fail and come back relatively unscarred? It is easy enough to see how this kind of capitalism can succeed in America because of the infrastructure and experience are here, the institutions, the laws, the history. But this system is at great odds with the European and Japanese traditions, to say nothing of those of China and India. In those societies, stability takes precedence over dynamic change. Individual freedom, political, economic, takes the backseat to political order. Everything about the way American way is a challenge to the traditional values of these and many other cultures. If all this is true, why haven't we already seen the revolt of our American intrusion? Answer, it is true. There has not yet been a concerted backlash, but it's too early to rule out. In many countries, the reforms, the legal challenges, and the enforcement, the implications of transparency and accountability are either very recent or still lie ahead. The fact is, markets move much faster than the foundations on which they rest. A decade of political and economic change abroad, most of it occurring against the backdrop of rising prosperity, is not long enough for Americans to declare victory. It remains to be seen how a European Union, with over a dozen new members, will ultimately try to shape its political and social compromises. U.S.-style capitalism is just now beginning to penetrate Japan and has a long way to go there. Moreover, it is not clear that in the developing world, the U.S. system will be the preferred approach in dealing with the crushing burdens of poverty, population growth, and environmental pressures.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
Every year, countless people succumb to the temptation to purchase exotic animals like hedgehogs, lizards, monkeys, even tigers and bears to keep as pets. But life in captivity is often a death sentence for these animals, who may suffer from malnutrition, an improper environment, and the stress of confinement. For more information on this issue, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We're looking at the book, The Mind of the CEO, looking at the future of the corporation in a rapidly changing world, by Jeffrey E. Garten. We were looking at the chapter Pax Americana. In many emerging markets, there's a great difference between form and substance. There may be lots of new regulations, but they cannot be implemented because of a lack of human and technical resources. I remember sitting next to a minister from the Chinese government at a banquet in Washington in 1994. We were talking about the need to protect intellectual property rights, a highly sensitive topic at the time, since the Clinton administration was about to threaten the imposition of large sanctions for Chinese violations of agreements. The minister didn't deny the importance of intellectual property rights, but he explained the difficulty China had in dealing with the issue. "We accept the need for the laws," he said. "We've even written them and put them on the books, but we don't have a court system to enforce them. Without a system of adjudication and enforcement, I realized all the assumptions that my colleagues and I were making about Chinese ability to undertake new obligations for the protection of copyrights, trademarks, and patents were flawed." There's a similar question when it comes to other aspects of the transition that China is trying to make to a market economy. In the summer of 2000, Chinese workers held six foreign managers hostage for 48 hours in a factory outside of the industrial city of Tianjin. The angry workers had been laid off, just as many other Chinese workers had been and will continue to be, as the inefficient state-owned enterprises are closed or sold to private investors. Elizabeth Rosenthal of the New York Times identified the horrific picture that will be emerging when she wrote, quote, "It has been a painful and confusing time for China's tens of millions of workers." Echoing similar privatization efforts in the former Soviet bloc, the workers are unfamiliar with the intricacies of buyouts and severance packages, generally lacking effective labor unions and having little outlet for their complaints. Finally, while no one doubts Americans' overall technological superiority, here too has possibly become too complacent. A good deal of the U.S. lead derives from enormous defense-related investments during the Cold War, the Internet being a prime example. It may well be impossible to keep up with the pace without a foreign threat, and is unlikely that private companies, obsessed as they are with the bottom line, will entirely fill the role of Defense Department once played in encouraging and funding innovation. In addition, the diffusion of U.S. technological genius to other countries is sure to accelerate, undercutting its advantages. As multinational companies like IBM establish state-of-the-art research labs all over the world, employing highly skilled foreign nationals in all of them, as foreign companies like the former Daimler-Benz increase their acquisitions of U.S. companies, and as ever larger percentages of engineers trained in the United States come from abroad, as the Internet weakens protection of intellectual property, as all this happens, it will become increasingly difficult for the United States to maintain the overwhelming technological edge it now has. Will the United States be up to the task of creating the right political environment for its economic goals to be achieved? Market forces, entrepreneurship, and the desire for free choice are all embodied in globalization, and these forces have strong momentum. However, economics has never existed in a political vacuum. As economy, national or international, needs someone to set the rules and someone to enforce them. In the last global age of capitalism, namely 1860 to 1914, that role fell to Great Britain. After World War I, the mantle was transferred to the United States. In the 1930s, Washington ignored its leadership responsibilities and therefore contributed to the economic breakdown itself, one of the main causes for the breakout of World War II. For four decades afterwards, the United States played the role Great Britain once did with regard to the non-communist world. Since the collapse of the former Soviet Union, the United States has been the sole global leader. Is it inevitable that this will continue? There can be no definite answer, of course, but it is instructive to look at some of the anti-American measures which are now building. Even as consumers everywhere embrace Hollywood, McDonald's, and the National Basketball Association, there is growing displeasure with the way Washington has thrown its weight around in NATO, the World Trade Organization, and the International Monetary Fund. There is particular suspicion almost everywhere in the world about the U.S. tendency to act unilaterally, such as in their public pronouncements about what other countries should be doing regarding human rights, birth control, narcotics, weapon sales, or even relationships with Cuba, and its threats to apply economic sanctions if they don't change their ways. America's trade and foreign policy in the early to late 1990s was a textbook case for throwing one's weight around in a counterproductive way. Some of this activity was understandable. Some went way too far. Admittedly, I played a part in it as well. When Bill Clinton was elected president in 1992, there was still a widespread perception in the United States that the U.S. competitiveness was lagging, particularly vis-a-vis Japan. There was a consensus among presidents and top economic officials that companies in Japan and Europe were deriving significant benefits in international competitions because they were being supported by their governments. The new administration was keen to show that it too could play that game. Secretary Ron Brown had a common refrain, quote, "We don't just want to level the playing field," he would say. Quote, "We want to tilt it toward American firms." The administration proceeded to move aggressively on behalf of U.S. companies. There were high-profile government-led trade missions in which the country's top CEOs enthusiastically participated. There was presidential arm-twisting of foreign governments to persuade them to award contracts to U.S. firms that were competing abroad with other companies Washington alleged were backed by their governments. A quote-unquote war room was established in the Department of Commerce to organize U.S. government help, including financing to hundreds of U.S. companies, big and small, to win foreign contracts. We're going to be looking at this and probably leading to the conclusion of this book in future shows, and so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Share music and voices from genres and cultures around the world, reflecting you and the rest of your community. You make CJSF diverse.
Madeline Taylor.